Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Jilly Jeezy, and I am here with Family Matters. Everybody, this is a great night. I want to announce something that's so exciting tonight. We are going to be making a movie, which is exciting, called Sunday Morning. The script is just finished. It is a short movie. It's going to be filmed in Springfield, Illinois, but people are coming from L.A. to do the production. Dawn Fields, Palm Street Films will be here, and it is so exciting to me. It is a movie about divorce and parental alienation and what parents should be and should not be doing through adversarial divorce. And I think you're really, really going to like it. I have Mick Gerhardt on the line right now. Hi, Mick.
Hey, Jill.
How are you?
Pretty good.
Mick, of course, isn't it? Oh, I'm doing okay. I told you earlier I hit my head just a little while ago, and I think I've given myself some crazy concussion because I have a splitting headache. So if I have to leave to go to the hospital, you'll know why.
Okay.
But I wanted
to.
Do you
need a lawyer? Somebody we can
no,
see?
No, I'm good. No. I can't see myself, so I'm good. Mick is a lawyer from Chicago and is very, very involved in the advocacy movement here in Illinois to change laws, to make new laws, to affect change and divorce culture here in Illinois, and that is born out of his personal issues that he has with the family courts here in Illinois. He also hosts a television show in Chicago and is just really an up-and-comer, and, you know, really not even an up-and-comer. You're one of the main guys on the forefront of change here in Illinois, so I'm excited to have you here tonight. Mick, I sent you this script earlier, and without revealing too much, what do you think?
I think it's a great idea. I mean, I won't say I'd like the ending, obviously.
Don't talk about the ending. Don't spoil it.
We won't talk
this
about
it. This is what my mother does. She tells a joke and tells the punchline first. So don't spoil it. But, yeah, the ending, I mean, it is chilling.
It's very realistic. And, I mean, I've heard stories like this before. And I think that really hits the point home that people just don't understand.
You're right. And I think this is a way, even though it's a short film, meaning it's only about 10 to 15 minutes long, I think it's really going to get people talking. They're going to understand the concept of using your children as a battleground and weapons in divorce and what that might entail. And it is very, very chilling. And it is an extreme case of what can happen. But boy, oh boy, it really, really gets the point across. I'm hoping that we get some real great feedback and people get involved in working towards change in divorce culture, not only in Illinois, but across the nation and globally. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I think lots of people don't understand all those. What I read, it doesn't exactly show the kids' perspective, but it shows effects on the kids.
Right.
Right. In the middle of this battle.
You're right. So hopefully August, second week in August, we'll be filming, and everybody will be able to see that film. We are thinking of entering it in Sundance, which is an exciting exciting move for all of us that, you know, we're just little Central Illinois guys and gals trying to make a difference. So, what's going on in Illinois as far as legislation and?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I know the one that we have passed, the main one that we have passed this legislative session was the House Bill 2992, right of first refusal. It passed through the House unanimously, the Senate unanimously, and it was sent to the governor. Well, it was officially sent to the governor today.
Oh, great!
So I thought was hoping it was before, because I was pushing to have it signed, you know, just before Father's Day or something along that line, because there were also those Fatherless Day rallies that were around the state. And I was hoping that it would, you know, go in conjunction with that, but it didn't quite go there. But I know it went to the governor today.
And that'll be a ceremonial signing, Mick, or will they judge
I do not know. I asked that it be a ceremonial signing, and I asked for that several weeks ago, right after it passed the Senate. I asked for it, and I never heard back from the governor or any of his people. So I'm not sure what his intentions were.
Well, I don't know if our governor is very vested in family issues. He's got so much more going on right now with pension reform and all of the things that Illinois isn't doing right as far as economics in our state. But we do get family law sort of right. If we could just get the governor on board with us, you know, it would be a great thing. Anything else? I mean, we're out of session now, Mick. They've got special session yes. going on. But anything else coming up that you know of? I mean, we won't have anything until veto session in the fall. But
correct. We don't. But there were several bills that were introduced last time, and they ran out of time, so went back into the Rules Committee or the Activity Committee, I think it's called, on the Senate side. And we're looking at those. I've been speaking to a couple legislators. I know one that was actually kind of interesting was a real simple bill by Mike Zalewski, where it required guardian ad litem training to include the word training on parental alienation.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And that's all it did was to add that word. And from what I was told, there weren't, there are lots of supporters, but there was one big objection, and that was they did not like the words parental alienation, and that came from DCFS.
Yeah, and we don't care what they call it, do we?
Well, now I think we can override DCFS's objection because the DSM-5 came out and uses the word child psychological abuse. So I'm going to ask Representative Zalewski to change the wording from parental alienation to child psychological abuse. And I don't see how anyone can object to it now because now we're using the actual wording straight out of DSM-5.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, I appreciate you coming on to give me updates, and you keep up your television show. And if you want to come down and be an extra in the movie, we would love to have you on Sunday morning. You and Ruby can come on down and be extras. We'd love it.
I'd definitely be an extra, the ugly guy in the background.
The ugly guy in the background.
The scary-looking guy in the background.
Semper Fi. you hang in there, Mick, and I will talk to you soon, and I really, really appreciate the update. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye. Well, tonight we have a really interesting show, and I want all of you to pay attention to what we're about to embark on is a story of a wonderful woman who is with me now. Nita, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, Nita. It's so
Hello.
Nice to talk to you. Nita Whitaker LaFontaine is with us from California, and I'm happy to say tonight, Nita, that we're here in Illinois and we have lovely weather. I haven't been able to say that too much. So,
well, good
so
for
I hope,
you.
I hope it's finding you. The weather is finding you lovely in California. How is it there?
It's pretty spectacular. Pretty spectacular. Yeah, it's
good,
a great
good,
day.
Good. Oh, I'm so glad. I was just telling an attorney from Chicago that I was talking to that we're I have a dear friend in LA and have been flying back and forth working on a movie. And I know you don't know a lot about what I do, but my wheelhouse is adversarial divorce, parental alienation, meaning when one parent turns the children against the other parent through adversarial divorce. And I wrote a book as well called The Look of Love, a novel dealing with this issue. And so we're making a movie, and we're kind of transporting everybody here to Illinois to do that because it's a little friendlier to make a movie here. So we're doing that filming in August, and I'm just excited that we're finalizing
How
some
exciting.
Of the details today.
And a topic that comes up for a lot of people, and I'm sure with your research and just having friends, you know, and seeing people go through it, the people that get the short end of the stick are the kids.
It really is. They are the true victims. I have a lot of parents that I talk to, and I had an international organization that deals with this, a lot of the parents that I talk to when they first come to me are under the impression they're the victims. But you have to really peel back the onion and say, no, the children who are going to suffer the long-lasting effects of this are really the ones who lose.
That's really true. I eavesdropped, this was some years ago, I was sitting in the restaurant for lunch, having lunch by myself one day, and there were two gentlemen talking, and I just happened to be there, and they happened to be there. I didn't know them, they didn't know me, and I was having a salad, and they were eating, and one was counseling the younger one about taking care of his kids because he was angry with the wife, and he said, you know, you have to take care of your wife because she has your most precious asset, your children. And if you, he said, you know, and I was doing all this acting out, and he said something so interesting. He said, my character didn't match my talent.
Ah.
I thought, isn't that interesting? Because he was an actor, and he was having some success, I think. I didn't want to get in a conversation, but
right.
He thought it was, you know, he really was speaking a lot of interesting information to this young man who was stuck in anger. And
well,
so I just thought of that as when you were talking about your book and your and
that's an interesting
yeah.
story. And I work with a lot of celebrities that have this issue who I wish after it's resolved or, you know, if it is never resolved that they would speak out a little bit more, because I think
yeah.
we really need to call attention to this. And it is a horrible thing, and it's happening all day long, every day, to hundreds of thousands of children across the United mm-hmm. States and globally. And we're going to make a difference. It's just going to take some time.
It.
I'm an alienated mom of four kids, and my family and I haven't seen my children for about 9.5 years. So it's an interesting story. And, you know, what I loved about your book, the concept of the book was that you can make it through anything. And so many of my parents and me and my parents, we have to say that, you know, you got to put on your boots and you've got to pull yourself up and you've got to keep going. When I get parents who come to me that are financially devastated through the family court system and they're emotionally devastated and psychologically devastated, it's so hard for them to keep going. But your book, Finding My Voice, My Journey Through Grief and to Grace, is a really good resource for them, because it shows how, I mean, your story is a little different. I mean, you're mm-hmm. trying to move on through the death of your husband, but it is a great motivator for people to say, look, you experienced this loss and they've experienced the loss of their children, which is like a death to them.
It is, indeed. The process of grieving is the same.
Yes, and you lay it out really wonderfully, and we're going to talk about the book in a little while, but I want to talk about you, because it's, you know, when I read the book, I love the book, I want to say that, but it
Thank
seems
you.
Like there's not enough about you, and Don, you know, I didn't know him, but I feel like I know him now. I feel like he's my friend after reading the book, and I feel like he would have been such an amazing man to know.
Everyone who had the pleasure to meet him feels that way. It's
of course.
It's a collective yay on that.
Well, I want to talk about you, because behind every man there's an amazing, you know, every great man there's an amazing woman, and you are clearly an amazing woman, and I just feel like you wrote the book as a cathartic exercise, you know, to heal,
mm-hmm.
but it's really an homage to Don. But let's lift Nita up and say, you know, you are a great woman who persevered through this and led your children through it. And so I want to hear about you. I want to hear about what happened, how you got to L.A.,
mm-hmm.
what happened when you were a child. What about your family? You came from Louisiana. Let's start there.
Okay. Shall we start there?
Yeah.
Okay. I try to put a little bit of me in the book, because I could have put a lot more, but then I wanted to be sure that people got a sense of Don, because the persona of him was different from who he really was. And I wanted to really tell more of our love story than more of my background. I touch on it. I talk about my home and leaving my comfortable and those kinds of things. But I was born and raised in Shreveport, Louisiana, a sleepy little town, third largest city in Louisiana at the time, and the youngest of four. And I had the blessing of great parents. A functional family, not a perfect family, but really good people. My dad is still my hero. My mother passed away when I was 17. So I had also gone through, I think I talk about that in
mm-hmm.
the book as well. I call that the book of mother. But I came from a very Christian, Baptist Christian background, sort of a rural Baptist upbringing with those kinds of morals and mores and lifestyle. Yeah. And we were, you know, busy with choir rehearsal or vacation Bible school or those kinds of things. My father and mother were very active in the church, so we were as a byproduct. So I just grew up sort of doing with them whatever they did. They were, my mother did
but a very strict upbringing.
Yes. Which I so appreciate. We weren't allowed to do a lot of things. We weren't allowed to wear shorts on Sunday. We weren't allowed to go over friends' houses and spend the night. And I didn't know any different. Everyone kind of did that. I had one best friend and, other than my family, and it was my first cousin, Debbie, and we would trade off on each other's homes on the weekends. I'd go to her house. She'd come to my house, and her house was a whole different world than my house, but it was, I learned a lot kind of being in that environment, but it was great. My neighbor, I lived in a neighborhood, we would walk the streets. I didn't have sidewalks. We had, when I was a little girl, they were gravel streets, and so we'd play ball in the streets because there was no park. I lived in a subdivision called Cedar Grove. I lived in a modest three-bedroom house that I thought was a palace because it was the nicest house on the block, and my father loved to take care of the yard, so it was always manicured with annuals and everything was trimmed. He would mow the yard twice a week because he just loved his yard to look great. So I grew up with a lot of love, strict parents, but they were strict but always loving. I never got a spanking. I don't spank my children. I saw my brother get a spanking, and I was very clear at 5 years old. I went to my dad, and I said, you know what? You never have to do that to me. You tell me what you don't want me to do, and I won't do it. And that was that.
Don't you think,
Nina?
You know, I say that all the time. I got one spanking my whole life, and I remember it being at my grandfather's farm in southern Illinois, and my sister and I were looking in the screen door, and my dad said, I want you to play outside. We don't want to play outside. It's too hot. We don't want to play outside. It's too hot. And he came out, and it wasn't even a real spanking. It was just a little tap, and I remember I peed my pants.
It's shocking because the one that you love the most – it's hurting you, and it doesn't make. And often it's reactionary, and that's why Don and I both made the conscious decision that we wouldn't. I think he had a moment where he did spank Sky once, and he felt horrible afterwards. And he's like, he gave her two swats on the behind. He was like, can't do that ever again. I was like, yep, told you.
But don't you feel like today everything is different. I mean, you and I would have never talked crossly to our parents or back-talked our parents or any of that. Yeah. And thank God we didn't have phones to text and all of those things that kids – I mean, I say that the downfall of American society is the Pong game that my dad bought when we were – you know, we were in the 70s. You know, it was a precursor to video games. I think it's a horrible thing that's happened to kids today, and I feel like we've raised a generation of entitled children.
They're so disconnected because they're in a small world of the TV or their device or whatever's right in front of them that they don't look up and out, look around, play outside, look at the sky, look at the grass, hug a tree. They're so isolated in their little video worlds or television or whatever it is that holds them. Where, you know, we would go outside every day. I mean, TV was you know, when I turned it on, there was a little dot in the middle, became a line, then you finally saw something.
Right.
There were three channels.
Yeah.
There were three channels.
And if we watched TV, it was the Brady Bunch or, you know, Bewitched or
Bewitched?
Some...
Oh, Green Acres, Petticoat Junction. Those were my favorites.
The best shows.
The best. And they were wholesome. There were some lessons. And I think some shows have come along since then, but they keep pushing what is appropriate for a 13-year-old, the PG-13. Mm-hmm. My children didn't watch PG-13 until they were 16. I was like, this is too much.
Yeah.
Because they keep pushing the envelope. But I don't know who makes that decision, but they're obviously not a mom.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
How do you think your parents and your upbringing carried over into your parenting style?
Well, I think the foundation of love, I always, always, always knew I was loved. Even when I got a fussing or when I didn't get what I want, I always knew I was loved because there was a hug coming somewhere in the day. Or my dad would scoop me up and carry me on his back, or he would come in from a long day of work and he would let us ride, piggyback my sister and I both on his back after working a 16-hour day. I knew that I had a safe place, and I wanted to give my children that. Don and I wanted to create a safe nest home environment where there was peace and harmony and love and laughter and singing and joy, and also rules, and but not so the things that my parents gave me were a moral compass, which came through being in the church. We raised our girls with a little less strict with interdenominational kind of church, but mm-hmm. they did then get those good foundations taught to them at an early age, and we wanted to give them our time.
Yeah,
because that's something that, and that's what my parents, even though my dad worked, we always had one parent as a constant. If one wasn't there, the other one was there, and we were always together on the weekend doing church things and singing or going to baseball games. And so those simple things, having a dinner time.
I was just going to say, having meals together, which
having
I think nobody
together.
Does anymore.
Yeah, having a ritual to the day. We know we got to get up for school. Thus, there were some simple things that we brought over. And I think they were the basic things like safety and love and a sense of well-being in their home so that they can go out into the world and be little confident beings, you know, as much as you can be as you're growing.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the main things, and that faith foundation that we wanted to be able to give them, because we both had that as well.
Well, the church was really very, very important to you as you grew up, but the singing and what you did as you grew older was certainly shaped by that. So you sang in church?
Sang in church. I did my first solo on the offering table. Yes, Jesus loves me. I don't remember it. My father tells me the story often. First time he ever cried, he said. People, my aunt remembers it, and my mom's sister. And but I loved music. My dad was a singer, so often before I even knew the words, I'm told I would just throw my head back and sing. Mm-hmm. Whether I just kind of eye it, because I didn't know the words, because I was at three, I didn't know what I was singing, but I knew all the words to that song, and I was like, I want to sing. I planted me on the offering table, and there I sang the whole song, verses and choruses, and my dad was like, oh my gosh, I have a singer on my hands. And so that was my sort of foundation, and it was beautiful harmony. When my first church was a rural church that was down a dirt road, set off the side of the road, and behind it ran a stream of some sort, and it was up on cinder blocks, white with a steeple on the top, wooden floors, wooden pews. There was no music except a piano, so people clapped their heels, and the singing would just kind of gather. I mean, there was always harmony. I remember that. And my dad had a singing group. So I started singing. I grew up hearing that. So I started singing solos at the front person with my sisters as the Whitaker sisters when I was about five. And I started doing solos probably around that time, too. And I think I make reference to the time I went to my cousin's church in Dallas and had that sort of Holy Ghost experience that scared the bejesus out of me.
People who haven't experienced that, I have no idea what you're talking about, but it's really something.
They have no idea. I mean, it is like something. I mean, you're 6 years old, it was like a lot, but it was pretty amazing when I looked at it, you know, retrospectively. So I began singing there, and then I was invited to sing at my dad worked for the power company as a janitor in the evenings, and they would have a Christmas party. And for about 5 years, I went and sang "I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus." There were like 800 people. I was the featured singer. So I did that, and of course, I was always singing in church, doing solos and whatever. I never learned to be afraid. So I just grew up. It was just as natural as breathing for me.
And you never got that nervous stomach.
I never got it because I never had a chance to learn it. I just was always singing.
Do you think not having that fear helped shape who you were and helped you through difficult situations in your life?
I always had this sense. My parents had said to me, you know, you have a gift, and it's yours to take care of, and it's meant to be shared. So I always felt like every time I was asked to sing, and I still feel this way, that it's such a blessing that someone wants to hear you sing. They don't have to ask you to do anything. And so I've always, every time I get an opportunity to sing, I'm just thrilled about it because I just think that it is such a gift to be able to do it, to be given a gift to sing, and then to be able to share that gift is like even better. So I always felt like I didn't own this gift, like it was given to me. It was truly a gift. So I felt a sense of honor when I was asked to step forward and sing, not not shy. It's like, oh, I got to share this. Oh, yay. That was kind of how I felt. So singing has been a part of my life for me, like breathing. It is like oxygen to me. I have to do it. There's some part of me every day that's singing something somewhere in the car, in the shower, in the house, because my house kind of rings and I can sing really loud in here, and I love it. And the garage is even better. I mean, my neighbor's like, Anita, singing. I open the windows and I'm just doing arias, and just because it's just fun. It's just joyful to me. But singing has, like I said, been a part of my life. And when I was about 15, my mother wanted to get me into a pageant because she thought the exposure would be great for me as a singer, you know, a local girl. And that didn't happen. And when I went off to college, I entered a pageant as a way to get to know girls. And I sang. I used to play piano. I play a little bit. I'm not great, but I play at it a little bit. And I played and sang a song that I had written. I started writing songs when I was 13, 14, but I didn't know call it writing songs. I was just making stuff up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't call it songwriting. I was just making stuff up. And I'd sing it for a few people. And I had a choir when I was in high school called the Gospel Fires, and I would write songs for them. And they would sing them. And you know, but I didn't think of it, you know, in the South you're taught, oh, that's cool. Shine your light, but not too bright. Who do you think you are trying to be better than the rest of us?
Yeah.
You know, so that was that kind of thing. So I never thought a lot about what I was doing. I was just doing what was natural for me. And one of my favorite stories is I was learning violin, and when they had arts in public schools, I was playing violin in probably seventh grade, and it was pretty screechy. I think I was playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, and I was just hitting every discordant, you know, sound like a saw. Yeah.
Yeah.
And my sisters were just, I mean, all of my siblings played instruments. My sister played, Aline played oboe. She played a lot of woodwinds. Kathy played the clarinet. And we all played the piano. My mother could read music. She didn't really play, but she wanted us to know music, so we all had music lessons of some sort, but my music teacher was horrible. She hit me with a wire hanger on my knuckles because I could play it by ear, and she wanted me to look at the notes. And I was like, so I stopped going, and I didn't tell my mom because I was embarrassed that I was not looking at. So I didn't tell my mom until the teacher called her and said, Nita's not coming to class, and she was around the corner from us. And I told mom why. Oh, boy, she was not happy about that. So I didn't go to classes for a long time, but then I found the violin. I liked that for a bit. And I just think that when I had those classes, it was just I was in the Junior Symphony. I just always had music around me in my life. But one of the times I was playing at home, and I was really screeching it out in the bathroom, and my sister yelled out, Daddy, make me to stop playing that noise. And my dad says, close your door. He got it.
Yeah.
Close your door. If you don't want to hear it, close your door. She's going to practice. Harvard Center.
Yeah.
That to me was like, he gave me the thumbs up. You go, baby. And I was
you're
like,
trying and go for it.
Yeah, yeah. Close your door. If you don't want to hear it, close your door. I love that.
So
one of the most,
You went on to become a Miss Louisiana.
Yes, I did. And it's, interestingly enough, there's a an anniversary reunion of us old queens. And I live in L.A. That's a really, that's a double sided word. in Monroe, Louisiana this year. So I'm going to see a bunch of my old comrades down there. But, yes, I did. That same voice that took me to college, and I got my nursing degree, but I found a voice class there at school, and I studied all the way through, taking voice classes, private lessons from Mr. Neighbors there. And he really wanted to pull out this legit side of my voice. I said, I have no desire to sing Aida, none.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but you should, and you can, and you will. So he worked with me on developing that part of my voice, which I thought was wasted time, but it served me very well because it gave me great technique for keeping my voice healthy. So that led me to probably about 15 pageants, in which I competed before I won the, about 15 pageants before I won the first local pageant. And
mm-hmm.
again, I was in the South, only black girl in the pageants. I'm like, there's got to be some other girls here. I know I'm not the only girl who wants to win this or try for this, but often I was the only black girl in the competition. But it didn't bother me. People are people, you know. So I was meeting people and meeting new people, and I just it didn't. It was never an issue for me. Never. People are just people. My parents taught us that. They're just people. No matter what color box you come here in, they're just people. So I would just go out there and do my best. And talent at the time was 50%. And usually whoever won talent would win the pageant.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a black girl. That was not happening. I was winning the talent, winning interview, but I didn't have a great swimsuit figure. I was really skinny. And you were supposed to have these three diamonds.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
top of your thigh, you know, the knees and the calf. Well, nothing was touching at the time. That has since changed. But it was, I didn't have that perfect swimsuit body, but I was winning everything else. So I would get fourth runner up, third runner up, whatever. Finally, I won a pageant. I think it was, oh, gosh, what was the first one? I think it was my hometown, Miss Shreveport. I think it was, and mm-hmm. my first try to Miss Louisiana. So it took me four tries, meaning you have to win a local preliminary, and then you go to the state. So it took me 15 pageants to win the first one, and then three more tries before I finally won.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I just don't take no for an answer. That's my...
Yeah, you got to keep it up.
You got to keep it up. Perseverance is omnipotent. It's omnipotent. If you just don't give up, you know, you'll get through. You may not land where you want to, but you'll be on higher ground. So I just sort of had this thing that I wanted to win this, not because I thought it was the most beautiful, but I knew that I was talented, and I knew that if I got to Miss America, I would get some different kind of exposure for my singing, which is what I wanted
yeah.
to do. But I had the security of my nursing degree so I could work. I could make a decent living and support myself. And off I went because, you know, I was very practical. You have to have, I couldn't just do the art thing, which is what I really would have loved to do,
mm-hmm.
but that wasn't practical. So off I went and went to Miss America. Timing was not so great. Vanessa Williams had, you know, the pictures came out, and it was just not a good year to be black that year. It just wasn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, timing is everything. I was like, you know, I don't have a snowball. A snowflake chance in hell of winning this thing, but I'm going anyway.
And
I had a great... Say it again?
How did you do? Were you in the top 10?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nada. That was the year there was the most at the time. There were the most black contestants in the history of the pageant. There were six of us.
Mm-hmm.
And one girl, Miss Ohio, do I remember her name? Ruth Booker? No. One girl was in the top 10. And
mm-hmm.
one of my girlfriends, who I'm still friends with, Marilyn Blackburn, who beat out Sarah Palin in Alaska.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was chosen for the USO Tour. I got nothing. And
wow.
interestingly enough, I've become friends over the years with Sam Haskell, who now runs the pageant.
Mm-hmm.
And he's followed my career because he was voting for me. They hired celebrity judges who didn't know about judging. So we had Pearl Bailey and Leonard Nimoy and I forget who else was there, but they didn't even know where to mark the ballot. So they were kind of all over the place. He shared that with me later, that they just kind of didn't know. And he was like, are you guys voting? And they were like, well, where do we mark? In the middle of the competition. Anyway, that wasn't meant for me. I get that. But I got nothing. I didn't even get a non-talent finalist. And it was a big lesson for me because, you know, they felt like they were sending their strongest contestant. And I think Louisiana, honestly, needed permission of a black girl winning before they allowed me to go because I could have gone the year before and I would have competed with Vanessa. But that's what it was, and that was the time, and that's what it was.
So your next step was onward and upward to California.
Yeah. I said, okay, got to get out of here. I can't do any more here. So there I went. I jumped in my little car that I bought for myself, and I drove out to L.A. because I knew I had to go to it. It wasn't going to come to Shreveport. Either it was going to be New York or L.A. So I just had L.A. because I like warm. So out I came, and in the first month, I think I was introduced to Don. I didn't, you know, it wasn't like an introduction, like a blind date. It was just he was in the club that was singing.
Yeah.
And that was how we met. And let's see, we started dating. I was started singing and doing little competitions, just trying to get my feet wet because pageant audiences are very, I think I talk about it in the book, they're very unusual. They make
mm-hmm.
you really think you're a rock star. You don't really
yeah.
have a sense of who you are because they support you so much. So anything, if you do anything halfway outstanding, they will cheer like you are Beyonce. I mean, really,
mm-hmm.
screaming and carrying on. So
yeah.
working the LA audience was new for me, and I felt like I had to prove myself as a singer. So within about 2 weeks, I was singing, and that was pretty cool, and that Don was in the audience, and I think after we met, and then he asked me out like in December of that year, and then we started dating. But then I was on the road with Ben Vereen, and so it was kind of, I was in and out quite a bit. But we
yeah.
kind of cultivated a relationship, because I was in and out quite a bit. And
it's interesting to me, though, if you read the book, that this is, and I want to refer to one particular part in the book where you are talking about being married to Don was like an amusement park. There were thrill rides and carousels and music in the air, along with the excitement of waiting in line for the next wild ride. Oh, I love that. That's exactly how I feel about my husband. But I want to say to you that when you met, it wasn't love at first sight, was it?
No, not even second sight, because he was an older white guy. And I'm thinking, what does he want with me? And I'm sure he's thinking, what does she want with me? Because I was like, hi, friend, nice to see you, and thanks for having us over at your home. I was not interested. In fact, I had sworn off guys. It was all about career and work. That's all I wanted to do. And there he was. He sort of took a liking to me, and I think I say it in the book, he said this one line. We were at his house because he would invite us back over and sing and do their little comedy. He had a little stage in his house. And he sat down in front of me with a drink in his hand. He goes, I like the concept of you.
Oh.
What the hell does that mean?
Yeah, it sounds sort of patronizing, doesn't it, a little bit?
Well, it was, you know, Don, it was so esoteric with his language, and he was a wordsmith. And so he would say, it was beautiful the way he said it. I think it was like, I haven't met anybody. You're just such a different being than I've ever met, which was kind of what he was saying in his very Don way. He was just, he had to find, it wasn't like, can I have your number? He had to go a different route.
But did you feel like when he said that the concept of you was you're a beautiful black girl and that's what I like about you? I mean, were you suspect at first?
Well, you know, I ask him that. I don't hold my tongue when I want to know something. I will ask point blank. I will just ask. I said, are you just interested in having a black girl? Is that what this is about? He was like, oh, absolutely not. He said, I just think you're just the most interesting creature I've ever met. Creature? What am I, a monkey? You know.
I love
that.
It.
Was me.
I love that.
Yeah. And of course, he always had some kind of quick retort because he was so quick on his feet. But he always had something going on and some idea of the next thing he wanted to do. And you know, right away he tried to give me. I said, I don't want anything. Stop giving me stuff. You can't impress me that way. Mm-hmm. I was so not. I always knew I didn't want to be kept. And I didn't want to be, you know, a mistress, and I didn't want to feel like I owed anybody anything. And I just thought that was inappropriate to accept things from someone you weren't in a relationship with. And even when I was like, stop giving me stuff. He was always trying. But he loved it. He said, you don't get it. I get the joy. I'm like, oh, yeah, right. But truly, that was the essence of the man.
That old adage, it's, you know, better to give than to receive, and he loved giving things to you,
he
and I have that same experience. My husband is 23 years older than I am.
I think that works.
I do, too.
Because they hold us. I mean, he thought me wonderful. And, you know, some of the young guys who are still figuring out who they are, Don knew who he was.
Yes.
He knew the man he was, and he had an evolution himself. You know, he wasn't always as maybe sure of himself, maybe in his other marriage. I don't know. I wasn't there. But I think he had a really good sense of who he was. I think he's always had that. But it was just in a more assured place. And I think the age difference for me was perfect. Perfect. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could have been as happy with someone my age who was still in
absolutely
the struggle and the fight.
Yeah, I agree with you. And don't you think you brought things to the table as a younger woman, as a black woman, you know, just different experiences, different thoughts, different ways of thinking about things that you did on an everyday basis that would change the way that he behaved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I really feel like we enhanced each other's lives. And isn't that what a relationship is supposed to be?
Of course.
And he was such a romantic. He loved courting me, and I loved being courted. But initially, you know, Don sees something he wants, he goes for it. So I wasn't on that same page initially. I was like, whoa, pony, you are rolling too fast. Slow your roll. But he was very clear. When he got clear that he wanted to be with me, he made it known to everybody.
Yeah.
He let me know, and I was like, well, just give me a minute. You just I'm just getting here. Can I just breathe a second? But
so
he was very
what
focused.
What did Dad and Mom say about all this? What, you know, you're going to marry an older white guy. Now, what is that conversation like when you call home?
Well, the initial conversation, well, my sisters had met him. They came out. I was in a little competition called Stardom Pursuit. They came out, and they had met him, and he cooked a turkey dinner fit for a king for my sisters. He really wanted to, and he made the best mashed potatoes in this. My entire family, he makes the best mashed potatoes to this day. No one can top them.
Mm.
But he made a dinner, and he was just done. He sat at the head of the table, and he talked, and he told jokes, and he was just done. And this was, we had just, let me see, when did he, yeah, I think we, this was later, because when I first won the competition, I, you know, we weren't dating, we didn't start dating until later, so when my sister mm-hmm. came out and he made dinner for them, like, later in that year, 87, I think it was, he was just himself, and he was very charming, but he looked like, you know, a Hollywood bachelor. He had the
yeah.
Jaguar, the, you know, the two-tone Jaguar, you know, the medallion, the blow-dried hair, the very Burt Reynolds looking, the mustache. I mean, really, it was like too much. I'm like, so I assumed it was, but it just took 10 minutes of talking to him to see his heart. He was so open and so pure. He was so pure, such a pure light, and, you know, just wanted to see the good in everybody. I mean, that was, he was shrewd, but he was, more oftentimes loving and giving people the benefit of the doubt than he was.
Yeah.
And I love that about him. I learned a lot about not being so reserved because, you know, that would help anybody.
So but, your family.
My sisters were like, okay, well, we'll see how it goes. So they had met him and they had gone home and told my dad. And I said, don't tell Dad, I want to tell him. So the conversation was, I was on the road. I think I'd come off the road for, you know, 2 or 3 days. And I called my dad. I'm thinking, how am I going to get this in? I'm dating a white guy. So I said, hi, Dad. Hi, baby. How are you? Fat and middling. He goes, I said, well, he said, what's going on? I said, oh, you know, work. And I'm out with Ben. And it's so much fun. It's so great. And I said, so, Dad, yeah, I met this guy. Uh-huh. And, he's really nice, Dad. He's so funny. He takes us to the nicest places. He's white, and he is just the best. I kind of snuck it in there.
And he's white. And?
I just stuck it in there. And he's white. I just stuck it in there, and I waited for the shoe to drop. And so I stopped. I was just, and I waited for him to say something. I said, Dad, did you hear what I said? He said, what'd you say? I said he was white. So he treats you nice.
Aww.
Yes, sir. He does. Well, that's all that matters, doesn't it?
Aww.
I was like, really, Dad? So then in June of that year, Don's like, I have to go home because I talk about my dad all the time. I adore my father. We have such a beautiful relationship, and he's just a great counselor. He's wise. He's kind. He's been the backbone of our family, obviously. So Don's like, I'm coming with you. I'm like, no, not yet. We're going to Shreveport, Louisiana. He's like, no, I'm coming to meet your father. I'm like, okay.
That's
so
great.
He got a room at the hotel, and we got picked up, and a whole bunch of folk came. Cousins came to pick me up. They were like, I need his home. So I thought, okay. And I had these two little twin cousins. At the time, they were probably about 7 or 8. So we got the bags and everything. We putting them in the back of the car, and they were hugging me. My little cousin Dawn was yeah, my little cousin Dawn, and she was mm-hmm. 7, I remember. And so we get in the car with our luggage, and we're driving, and we're going to stop by my Aunt Jenny's, who is my dad's sister, who I love. I always have to see her every time I come. So we stop by Aunt Jenny's. Aunt Jenny has what's called a shotgun house. You know what that is?
Mm-mm,
you can
no.
shoot a gun from the front to the back. It's a straight shot back. That's why they call it a shotgun house.
Okay.
And it's a really tight quarters. She had a living room that had the plastic over the furniture, you know.
Yes.
And it was just enough room to get around the big table in the middle. It was just, you know, you squeezed in there. And so we're in Cedar Grove, and it's a small little house. And I grew up there, but it's, you know, Don's bathroom was the size of, you know, the house.
Yeah.
So we go in, and, you know, he's sitting there, and on the car ride home, my little cousin sneaked up to me. She goes, did you know he was white?
No.
I said, oh, I hadn't noticed, really. I said, well, he's just Don to me. So then when we get to my aunt's house, and he's sitting there, and my aunt's bringing in some trays of stuff, and she loved Don. She just loved him. Once she got to him, she just loved him. But she's just talking, and so we're all sitting in there kind of cramped up in the little house, and there's eight of us, and we're just sitting there just like sardines in a can, and I loved it. I look over at Don, and I keep looking and say, you okay? He's like, I'm okay. And my little cousin goes over, little Don, crawls up in his lap, and she gives him a big hug. She says, I have a white boyfriend, too. Well, that was
oh, my
it.
Goodness.
That was it. She broke the ice. He started laughing so loud, and then he just kind of let go. And it was just love from that moment on. Everybody that met him loved him. So when we finished that trip, that was when I was like, okay, family's cool with Don. Don's cool.
Yeah.
And it was just nothing but love. And then on the other side, you know, his mom, I think I alluded to in the book, and his mom heard that he called his mom and said, Mom, I've met the one. He told me this after the fact, of course, because I didn't know I was the one. I thought I was one of many, but he was very clear, don't, you're it. And his mom said, yeah, I heard she's kind of nice, but does she have to be black?
Yeah. I thought that was funny when I read that.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Well, she is, and you're stuck with it.
Yeah, he said, Mom, oh, you just need to meet her. And she and I were mother and daughter. We were mother and daughter. Every time we would have our, just she and I, we would go shopping. We'd step on the baby or something, and when we had the babies, put them in a stroller, we'd go shopping, and we'd chat about life and old times and good times and what Don did when he was a little boy. And it was great. She was really wonderful, kind.
Now, is she still living?
No, she isn't. She died in. She died 8 years ago.
8 years ago. You were with Don 22 years, married for 20.
Yes.
You had two beautiful children, and then of course he had a daughter from his previous marriage, which you call your bonus girl, is so great. and your family in the book, you have beautiful pictures of your family. Your girls are just stunning. Just
thank
like
you.
You are.
Thank
absolutely
you.
Gorgeous. I want to get, you know, we're you're so interesting, and we're going to be out of time, so we got to talk about the book a little bit
we
more.
Do. Please, let's talk about the book.
The concept of the book and how you got to where you were with the book. You went to a class after Don's passing.
Right. About a year later.
About a year later.
Yeah. The year that Don passed, I had a senior in high school. So we were applying to colleges, and then I had my younger daughter was transitioning from junior high to high school, so she was applying to high school, so I had two application processes going on. That was all that I did, just took care of whatever they needed. I would sing a gig here and there, but just really focus on them. And then
I mean, we're feeling lost, feeling lost, and you just had to be strong for them at that moment, probably not even dealing with what your feelings were right away.
Not right away, because I wanted to keep a watchful eye for them. So when Skye left to go to college, she was up northern California. It was just me and Leisha in the house. And Leisha's very verbal. She tells me everything she thinks or feels. I don't like it here with just you and me, she would say. You know, because we had two energies removed from our home. Instead of buying six bananas, I was buying three. It was the strangest thing. It was, instead of buying a gallon of milk, I bought a half gallon. Little things, little adjustments, making little adjustments. And I needed somewhere, because I was putting so much energy into my children, I needed something creative to do for myself. A girlfriend called me about the class. It was down the street, because I wouldn't leave Lisa for too long. She was eighth grade, and I wanted to be gone only a couple hours, because I just wanted to be close by. Worked out great. Met this wonderful, kind heart. She walked in. I didn't tell her my story. But I was still so broken. And just trying to function. And stepped to this class, and she would give us a prompt after we did some breathing, and it just began. And I didn't know that I was that. It wasn't a book, a class where you go to learn how to write a book. It wasn't. It was just a class to write to heal, and that was what I was doing. But before that, I had started doing these check-ins, which I include in the book, and people would say, Nita, you should share that. You should share that. You could help somebody else. So it was through that process of being in that class that that I said, wow, maybe I can do this. And I said to her, I said, I think there's a book in me. I think I want to share our love story and this journey that I'm on. And I just don't know how to begin. She said, I'll help you. And we began. We started with a proposal, which took about 4 months to write. She said usually it can take a year. I said, I don't have a year. I got to get this out of me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a very directed person, much like Don. If I get my sights set on something, I just become hyper-focused on it, and I would be up 2 or 3 in the morning and get up at 6 with the kids because my brain wouldn't shut off. So I was writing, and she would edit, write some more. You know, writing is rewriting. And so that's how the process began. Then we sent it out to agents, query letters, and then
mm-hmm.
followed up with whatever, you know, the process. And we got a great agent. And then from there, we didn't get picked up for a publishing deal. And I just said, you know what, I need to do this. I don't want – and if I got a publishing deal, I'll have to wait. And I just want to give this. I want to birth it because it's just like I needed to just let it go.
Yeah.
So I decided to go the independent route. And you know that the book has won 3 awards.
It's so wonderful.
Yeah, that's just something you don't plan for, but it's such a nice validation of being able to say that about your work. And I've always loved writing. I've always enjoyed reading, but I learned more about the love of reading because my husband was so voracious. So
mm-hmm.
the book, you know, we put it out there and we kind of let a few people know, and kind of word of mouth is spreading. And then it's just been an amazing gift to me because it was able to heal. Now, my children have not been able to read it. They read it up to about chapter, until day 9.
Mm-hmm.
They can't. Lisi read day 9 by accident. I was editing it, and it was on the computer downstairs. And there were 2 pages before the actual. And, you know, you're 14, you don't sit your child down and say, now this is what happened on the day daddy.
Yeah.
That's just inappropriate. And she actually
Someday.
She asked, but she read it. She read it, you know, because I take you through there with me. I bring you right to the bedside, everything that I, because it was playing like a movie in my head that until I put it on paper, I didn't know. I was able the first time to kind of get the pictures out of my head. I couldn't let it go. And so she read it, and she came in to the kitchen where I was sitting because I think I was outside looking, editing another part where that printed some things out, and it was still up. And I said, what's wrong, honey? She said, I just read day 9. And she fell apart. And I just stopped what I was doing, and I just went, Mother, you didn't tell me. You didn't tell me. I said, honey, it wasn't the appropriate time. And we came up to her room. We lay down. She said, I'll never get over this, Mommy. I'll never get over this. I'll never not miss my dad. I said, of course, you always miss Daddy. I understand. And I just lay there with her for 2 hours, and she cried.
Aww.
And, you know, so I said, when you're ready to read the rest of the book, you can read it. There's no hurry. There's no hurry. There's no pressure. But I included the letters. I told them I was going to include the letters. I wanted them each to write that. So the book for me was a healing process, as well as I hope that it can be a source of encouragement for people who are going through difficult times, like any kind of loss, because we all have to redefine our voices, redefine who we are without that thing, that lifestyle, that person, that group.
Mm-hmm.
We have to redefine ourselves. We have to find our voice.
Yeah, and reinvent. If you go through a divorce, you were a couple, you're not anymore.
Right.
If you go
through a
spouse, you're a couple, you're not anymore. You have to reinvent yourself as a single person
try
to move forward in a life that's so uncertain.
True, and the title for me is, of course, both literal and figuratively, because Don and I both used our voices to make a living, and also it was our livelihood, the thing we did the most, and I had a great partner. I had a wonderful husband. I had a blessed marriage. I always knew that. Don, we both did. We would always say that. How blessed are we? We would always say that to each other. And feeling halved when you've walked this journey with someone for 22 years who's been holding your hand and, honey, what are we going to do? And where are we going to go? And how are we going to do this? And how are we going to parent? I had a partner, a sounding board that was right here. Honey, I need a word. He had 25. I mean, silent. That voice that always had been my rock was no longer there. And it was really a journey for me to even really want to feel like singing again
mm-hmm.
and to get this roar back for life, this zest for life. I knew I had to move forward because if we had these beautiful children. But it was a journey to find my voice again without his.
But I know you feel like Don is with you still, and he's watching over you, and that he's an angel that's absolutely there with you, guiding you.
Yes. I was doing some ADR yesterday in the studio where I think my husband worked, mm-hmm. and it was the strangest thing. They closed the two doors, and the engineer went around, and there was this whistle. It was almost like the whistle on the end of his S's, and it hadn't happened all day. They'd had five or six people through, and he came in. He was trying to figure out, because it was like the air conditioning was whistling, and he just couldn't figure it out. And I said, you know, if I just crack this one door, I think it'll go away. So I cracked the door, I fixed it. I said, you know, that was my husband. And they got quiet, because I knew he was right there with me.
Well, it's got to send chills up your spine.
Yeah. But I'm so aware of his presence and guidance over the girls' lives. I just am grateful that I am in tune with him, that I can still feel his presence, because I think we still need to feel that the journey has been one of grace and one of crying nights and one of joyful moments and deep sadness, all of it. It has been the whole spectrum, but I think loss is that,
mm-hmm.
because that's
for
how
sure.
we grow to the next level where we reclaim our lives.
Well, Nina Whitaker LaFontaine's book, Finding My Voice, My Journey Through Grief to Grace, Living with the Loss of Don LaFontaine, can be purchased where, Nita?
Amazon and BarnesandNobles.com.
And BarnesandNobles.com. And
also
it is
downloadable.
Oh, it's downloadable. Great.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Mm-hmm. And is that downloadable at your website?
No, just on either of those sites.
Okay, perfect, perfect. Well, this is a book that truly, truly is a love story. And an award-winning book, as Nita said, has won 3 awards and probably will win more. And hopefully we will hear more from you, Nita. I don't know if you plan to be an author, but, I mean, obviously you've conquered your singing career and doing everything that you've done, singing with wonderful people. Michael Bublé wrote the foreword to your book. What an amazing guy.
And I sang it as well. In Argentina. He's just
did
the
you?
Loveliest. I did. He's a lovely being. I just adore him.
Well, I think everybody should run, not walk, and order this book and read it, especially if you're going through something in your life that has caused you to be sad, to not have hope. And I think this will really be uplifting to you. And I just applaud you for your work here and for having in your life these two wonderful girls, but most especially this husband that gave you this romance and this love and laughter and order and family and everything that a marriage
and freedom.
And freedom.
I think that was the beauty of our relationship, that he wasn't, love doesn't hold you, it lets you free, and he was always, do what you need to do. I got it. You go and do what you need to do. And I was the same with him. The freedom and the love was so beautiful.
But you know what's funny, and I think I have this feeling, you have the freedom, but even when you're off doing something on your own, you still feel them, even like with you now, with Don, you still feel them with you.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think so few people experience that.
Yeah, all of my girlfriends would say, when am I going to find my Don?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
because
it's
right. it was a beautiful love, and I know without a doubt that we were blessed and that we were supposed to journey together. I would have loved for another 20 years to have with him, to grow old and creaky and crotchety together.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The years that we got were so beautiful that I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that I knew how to be loved like that. It set the bar pretty high for anybody else who wants to try to be in my space, but
that's for sure.
Because he was just a prince. He was a prince of a man. He really, really, really was. And
I appreciate you so
and
much.
And I thank you for talking to me and talking about the book. I do hope it can be a source of encouragement and hope for others. Thank you so much.
Nita, thank you. And you have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And I want everybody to get out there and read this book. And we'll hopefully talk to you again soon. And much, much continued success.
Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Night-night.
Night.
Thanks for listening, everyone. This was Family Matters. We'll see you next time. I'm Jill Ajeezy. Bye-bye.